Now we all feel greatly indebted to the University of Virginia for making it possible for Mr. Foster to be here. We're indebted to Dr. Simpson, who made his addresses to the university, and of course, most of all, we are indebted to Mr. Foster himself for being willing to come over. I'm going to ask Professor Gwynn of the University Department of English to introduce Mr. Foster.
Thank you, Dr. Whitten. It might have been said at one time that Mr. Faulkner's works were known wherever the language was known. Today, it has gone far beyond, and wherever people read, his work is highly esteemed. It might be said fairly that he is the most distinguished writer in the world. At the University of Virginia, we've been proud of his presence and pleased with the response. It is a great privilege to come over and bring Mr. Faulkner this afternoon. He will read from his short story, Shingles for the Lord, and then answer any questions that may be on one's mind.
I've already found out that the only way to hold an audience is to be a little higher than it is, and for a short man like me, it's impossible to do it unless you are higher, so if it's all right, I'm going to stand up. Hap got up a good hour before daylight and caught the mule and rid down to Killigrew to borrow the crook. He ought to bend back with it in 40 minutes, but the sun had rose and I had done milk and fed and eaten my breakfast when he got back, with the mule not only in the leather but right on the edge of the thumps too. Fox hunting, he said, fox hunting. A 70-year-old man with both feet and one knee too already in the grave, squatting all night on the hill and calling himself listening to a fox race that he couldn't even hear unless they had come up onto the same log he was sitting on and bayed right into his ear trumpet. Give me my breakfast, he told Ma. Whitfield is standing there right this minute, standing at that board tree with his watch in his hand. And he was. We went on past the church, and there was not only stolen quick school bus truck, but Reverend Whitfield's old man too. We tied the mule to a sapling and hung our dinner bucket on a limb, and the pap told him Killigrew's throwing ball and the wedges, and me toting our axe, we went on to the board tree where Stolen and Homer Bookwright, with their throws and balls and axes and wedges, were setting on two up in the truck. And Whitfield was standing just like Pap said, in his boy's shirt and his black hat and pants and necktie, holding his watch in his hand. It was gold, and in the morning sunlight it looked big as a full-grown squash. You're late, he said. So Pap told him again about how old man Killigrew had been off fox hunting all night and nobody's home to lend him the throw with Miss Killigrew and the cook. And naturally, the cook wasn't going to lend none of Killigrew's tunes out, and Miss Killigrew was worse than death than even Killigrew. If you was to run in and tell her the house was afire, she would just keep on rocking and say she thought so too, unless she begun to holler back to the cook to turn the dogs loose before you could even open your mouth. You could have gone yesterday and borrowed the foal, which he had said. You had known for a month now that you had promised this one day out of the whole summer toward putting a roof on the house of God. We ain't but 2 hours late, Pat said. I reckon the Lord will forgive it. He ain't ever rested in time nohow. He's ever rested in salvation. Whitfield never even waited for Pat to finish. It looked to me like he even got taller, thundering down Pat like a cloudbird. He ain't ever rested in neither. Why should he be when he owns them both? And why should he turn around for the poor, miserable souls of men that can't even borrow tubes in time to replace the shingles on his church? I don't know either. Maybe it's just because he made them. Maybe he just said to himself, I made them, I don't know why. But since I did, I got there, I rolled my sleeves up and dragged them into glory like they're going to know. But that wasn't him, a bad meeting. And I reckon he knows, just like he knows there wasn't going to be nothing at all here as long as he stayed. So he put the watch back into his pocket and motioned Stolen and Homer up, and we all taken off our hats except him, while he stood there with his face raised into the sun, and his eyes shut, and his eyebrows looking like a big iron gray caterpillar laying along the edge of a cliff. Lord, you said, make them good straight shingles to lay smooth, and let them spit off heated there for you. And opened his eyes and looked at us again, woke their pets, and went and untied his man, come up slow and stiff, like old men do and rid away. Pat put down the throwing maul and laid the three wedges in a neat row on the ground and taken up the axe. Well, men, he said, let's get started. We already late. Me and Homer ain't, so he said. We was here. This time, him and Homer didn't step on the cuts. They squatted on that heel. Then I seen that Homer was whittling on a stick. I hadn't noticed it before. I made it 2 hours and a little over, so he said, more or less. Pat was still about half stooped over, holding the axe. It's now a one, he said, but call it two for the sake of the argument. What about it? What argument, Homer said. Well, like Pat said, 2 hours then. What about it? Which is 3 man-hour units the hour multiplied by 2 hours, so he said, or a total of 6 work units. When the WPNA first come to Dr. Potosa County and started giving out jobs and grub and mattresses, Solon went into Jefferson's to get on it. He would drive his school bus truck to 22 miles into town every morning and come back that night. He'd done that for almost a week before he found out he would not only have to sign his farm off into somebody else's name, he couldn't even own and run the school bus that he had built himself. So he come back that night and never went back no more. And since then, hadn't nobody ever mentioned WPNA to him unless they aimed to fight too. So every now and then he would turn up with something all figured down into work units like he'd done now. 6 units short. 4 of which you and Homer could have already worked out while you were sitting there waiting on me, Pat said. Except that we didn't, Solon said. We promised Whitfield 2 units of 12 3-unit hours toward getting some new shingles on the church roof. We've been here ever since summer, waiting for the 3rd unit to show up so we could get started. You don't seem to kept up with these modern ideas about work that's been flooding and uplifting the country in the last few years. What modern ideas, Pat said. I didn't know there was but one idea about work until it is done, it ain't done. And when it is done, it is. Homer made another long, steady but long stick. His knife was sharp as a razor. Solon took note of the snuff box and filled the top and tilted the snuff into his lip and offered the box to Homer. And Homer shaking his head, and Solon put the top back on the box and put the box back into his pocket. So, Pat said, just because I had to wait 2 hours for an old 70-year man to get back from fox hunting, that never had no more business setting out in the woods all night than he would have had setting all night in a highway juke joint, we all 3 got to come back tomorrow to finish in 2 hours at you and Homer. I ain't, Solon said. I don't know about Homer. I promised it to you one day. I was yet sun at the start. When the sun goes down, I will consider I have done finished. I see, Pat said. I see. It's me that's got to come back by myself. I got to break into a full morning to make up them 2 hours that you and Homer spent resting. I got to spend 2 hours of the next day making up for the 2 hours of the day before that you and Homer never even worked. It's going to more than just break into a morning, Solon said. It's going to wreck it. There's 6 units left over, 6 one-man-hour units. Maybe you can work twice as fast as me and Homer put together and finish them in 4 hours. But I don't believe you can work 3 times as fast and finish them in 2. Maybe there's something else besides cash you might be able to trade with, though, Solon said. You might use that doll. That was when Pat actually stopped. I didn't know it myself then either, but I found it out a good long time before Solon did. Pat sat there with the maul up over his head and the blade of the throw set against the block for the next lick, looking at Solon. The doll, he said. It was a kind of mixed hound with a little bird dog and some collie and maybe a considerable of almost anything else. But it would even skew the wood without no more noise than a hand and pick up a squirrel's trail on the ground and bark just once, unless it knowed you was where you couldn't see it, and then tiptoe that trail out just like a man and never make another sound until it treed, and only then when it knowed you hadn't kept in sight of it. It belonged to Pap and Brun and Tall together. Will Barney gave it to Tall as a puppy and Pap raised it for a half interest. Me and him trained it, and it slept in my bed with me until it got so big Ma finally run it out of the house. And for the last 6 months, Solon had been trying to buy it. Him and Tull had agreed on $2 for Tull's half of it, but Solon and Pap were still $6 apart on ours, because Pap said it was worth $10 of anybody's money. And if Tull wasn't going to collect his full half of that, he was going to collect the full. So that's it, Pap said. Them things wasn't work units at all. They were dog units. Just a suggestion, soul, just a friendly offer to keep them runaway sandals from breaking up your private business for 6 hours tomorrow morning. You sell me your half of that trick overgrown size, and I'll finish these shingles for you. Naturally, including them six extra units for $1, Pat said. No, soul, he said. I'll pay you the same $2 for your half of that doll that me and Todd beat on for his half of it. You meet me here tomorrow morning with the dog, and you can go back home or wherever the urgent private affairs are located and forget about that church. Your half of the dog for that half a day's work you still owe on them shingles, and the $2, Pap said, that you and Todd agreed on. I sell you half the dog for $2, and you come back here tomorrow to finish the shingles. You give me the $2 now, and I'll meet you here in the morning with the dog, and you can show me the receipt from Todd for his half of the day. Me and Todd have done already agreed, so he said. All right, Pat said, then you can pay Todd his $2 and bring his receipt with you without no trouble. Todd will be at the church tomorrow morning putting off some old shingles, so he said. All right, Pat said, then it won't be no trouble at all for you to get a receipt from him. You can stop at the church when you pass. Todd ain't named Greer. He won't need to be off somewhere tomorrow borrowing a crowbar. So Solon taken out his purse and paid Pat the $2, and they went back to work. And now it looked like they were really trying to finish that afternoon. Not just Solon, but even Homer, that didn't seem to be concerned in it nohow. And Pat, that had already swapped a half a dog to get rid of whatever work Solon claimed would be left over. I quit trying to stay up with him, then I just stacked shingles. Then Solon laid his straw and maul down. Well, men, he said, I don't know what you fellows think, but I can triple this a day. All right, Pat said, you're the one to decide when to quit, since whatever elbow unit you consider are going to be shot tomorrow is yours. That's a fact, Solon said. Since I'm giving a day and a half to the church instead of just a day like I started out doing, I reckon I'd better get on home and tend to a little of my own work. He picked up his straw and maul and axe and went on to his truck and stood waiting for Homer to come and get here. I'll be here in the morning with the dog, Pat said. Surely, Solon said. It sounded like he had forgot about the dog, or that it wasn't no longer any importance. But he stood there again and looked hard and proud at Pat for about a second. And a bill of sale from Todd for his half of it. As you say, it won't be no trouble at all to get that from him. Him and Homer got into the truck and he started the engine. He couldn't say just what it was. It was almost like Solon was hurting himself. So Pat wouldn't have to make any excuse or pretense toward doing or not doing anything. I have always understood the fact that lightning don't have to hit twice is one of the reasons why they named it lightning. So getting lightning struck is a mistake that might happen to any man. The mistake I seem to make is I never realized in time that what I was looking at was a cloud. I'll see you in the morning, with the dog, Pat said. Certainly, Solon said, again like they had switched his mind completely with the dog. Then him and Homer drove off. Then Pat got up. What? I said, what? You swapped in your half of Charles' dog for that half a day's work tomorrow. Now what? Yes, Pat. Oh, yes, Pat said. Only before that, I had already swapped Charles' half a day's work, putting off the old shingles tomorrow for Charles' half a day's work. Only we ain't going to wait until tomorrow. We're going to pull them shingles off tonight, and without no more racket about it than is necessary. I don't seem to have nothing on my mind tomorrow but watching Mr. Solon work me quick trying to get a bill of sale for $2 or $10 either or on the other half of that dollar. And we'll do it tonight. I don't want him just to find out at sun up tomorrow that he is too late. I want him to find out then that even when he laid down to sleep he was already too late. So we went back home and I stood and looked while Pat went down to Killigrew to carry the frozen mall back in the bar and cobalt. But of all places in the world and doing what under the sun with it, old man Killigrew had went and lost his crowbar out of the boat into 40 feet of water. And Pat said how he come within an inch of going to Solon's and borrowing his crowbar out of pure poetic justice. Only Solon might have smelled the rat just from the idea of the crowbar. So Pat went to Armstead and borrowed his and come back and the ex up and cleaned and filled the ladder while Maul still tried to find out what we was up to that couldn't wait till morning. We left her still talking, even as far as the front gate, and come on back to the church, walking this time, with the rope and crowbar and the hammer for me, and the lantern still gone. Quick feeling Snopes was unloading the ladder from Snopes' wagon when we passed the church on the way home before dawn, so all we had to do was to set the ladder up against the church. Then Pat clumb up onto the roof of the ladder and pulled off shingles until he could hang the lantern inside behind the decking, wet, it could shine out through the cracks in the planks, but you couldn't see it unless you were passing the rope. And by that time, anybody would already heard it. Then I clumb up with the rope and reached it through the decking and around the raft and back and tied the ends around our waist, and we started. And we went at it. We had the old shingle just raining down, me using the claw hammer and Pat using the crowbar. Wet in the barn to a whole patch of shingle at one time and then laying back on the bar like in one more lick, or if the crowbar ever happened for 1 second, we got a solid hold, he'd tilt that whole roof up one time like a hen's box to it. That's exactly what he finally done. He laid back on the bar and this time it got a hold. It wasn't just a patch of shingle, it was a whole section of decking. So that when he lunged back, he snatched that whole section of roof from around the ladder like he would shuck a corn nubbin. The ladder was hanging on a nail. He never even moved the nail. He just pulled the bolt off of it so that it looked like... For a whole minute, I watched the ladder and the crowbar too, sitting there in the empty air in a little mess of floating shingle, with the empty nail still sticking through the bale of the ladder before the whole thing started down into the church. It hit the floor and bounced once, and then it hit the floor again, and this time the whole church just blowed up into a pit of yellow jumping fire, with me and Pat hanging over the edge of it on two ropes. I don't know what became of the rope and how we got out of it. I don't remember climbing down, just Pat yelling behind me and pushing me halfway down the ladder, and then throwing me the rest of the way by a handful of my overalls, and then we were both on the ground running for the water now. It sat under the gutter spout at the side, and Armstrong was there then. He had happened to go out to his lot about an hour back and seen the Latin on the church. And it stayed on his mind till finally he come up to see what was going on, and got there just in time to stand yelling back and forth with Pap across the water now. And I believe we still would have put it out. Pap turned and squatted against the barrel and got a hold of it over his shoulder and stood up with that barrel that was almost full of water, and run around the corner up the steps of the church and hooked his toe on the top step and come down with a barrel busting on top of it. And nothing about cold as a ridge. So we had to drag him back first, and Maul was there then, and Mr. Armstead about the same time, and me and Armstead run with the two fire buckets to the spring, and when we got back there were plenty of them. Whitfield too, with more buckets, and we done what we could, but the spring was 200 yards away, and 10 buckets into it, and it had taken 5 minutes to fill again. So we finally all just stood around where Pat had come to again with a big cut on his head and watched it go. It was an old church, long dried out and full of old colored picture charts that Whitfield had accumulated for more than 50 years, that the lamp had lit right in the middle of and it finally exploded. There was a special nail where he would keep the old long night shirt he would wear to baptize in. I used to watch it all the time during church and Sunday school, and me and the other boys would go past the church sometimes just to peek in at it. Because to a boy of 10, it wasn't just a cloth garment or even an iron armor. It was the old, strong, archangel Michael himself that had stood and strove and conquered sin for so long that it finally had the same contempt for the human being that returned always to sin as hogs and dogs done, that the old, strong, archangel himself would have had. For a long time, it never burned. Even after everything else inside had, we could watch it hanging there among the fire. Not like it knowed its time, in its time too much water to burn either, but like it had stored and fit with the devil and all the hopes of hell too long to burn and just a fire that residue started, trying to beat soul and thick out of half a dollar. But at last it went too, not in a hurry still, but just all at once, kind of roaring right up on and out against the stars with the far dark spaces. And then there wasn't nothing but just Pat, resting and groggy looking on the ground, with the rest of us around him, and would feel like always in his boy's shirt and his black hat and pants. Standing there with his hat on, too, like he had strolled too long to save what hadn't ought to been freed in the first place, from the damnation he didn't even want to escape, to bother to need to take his hat off in any presence. He looked around at us from under. We was all there now, all that belonged to that church and needed to be born and married and died for. Us and the Armsteads and Charles and Bookwrights and Quick and Smoke. I was wrong, Whitfield said. I told you we would meet here tomorrow at the Rupert Church. We'd meet here in the morning to raise one. Of course we got to have a church, Pat said. We were going to have one, and we're going to have it soon. But there's some of us done already give a day or so this week at the cost of our own work, which is right and just, and we're going to give more, and glad to. But I don't believe the Lord. Whitfield let him finish. He never moved. He just stood there until Pat finally run down his own cord and pressed and sat down on the ground, hoping not looking at more. For Whitfield opened his mouth. Not you, Whitfield said. Arsonist? Arsonist counsel, guess what you said. If there's any pursuit in which you can engage without carrying flood and fire and destruction and death behind you, do it. But not one hand shall you lay to this new house until you prove to us that you are to be trusted again with the powers and capacities of a man. He looked about us again. Charlie and Snope and Armstrong have already promised for tomorrow. Understanding Quick had another half day he intended. I can give another day, so and said. I can give the rest of the week home, sir. I ain't rushed neither, Snope said. That would be enough to start with, then, his feet said. It's late now, let us all go home. He went first. He didn't look back once. At the church or us, he went to the old man, half slow and stiff and powerful, and looked on. And we went to scouting, but I looked back at it. It was just a shell now with a red and stained core, and I had hated it at times and feared it at others, and I would have been glad. I should have been glad. But there was something that even that fire hadn't even touched. Maybe that's all it was, just indestructibility, invulnerability. That old man that could plan to build it back while its walls were still fire pierced, and then calmly turn his back and go away, because he knows that the men that never had nothing to give towards the new one but their work would do that sort tomorrow, and the day after that, and the day after that too, as long as it was needed. Give that work to build it back again. So it hadn't gone at all. They didn't no more care for that little fire and flood than which he had old baptizing John had gone. Then he was home. Ma had left so fast, the lamp was still lit, and we could see Pat now, still leaving a puddle where he stood, with a cup across the back of his head, where the barrel was busted, and blood streaked water soaking into the waist. Get them wet clothes off, Ma said. I don't know as I will or not, Pat said. I've been publicly notified that I ain't fitting to associate with white folks. So I publicly notified them same white folks and Methodists too not to try to associate with Negroes again. But Ma hadn't even listened. When she come back with a pan of water and a towel and a liniment bottle, Pat was already in his nightshade. I don't want none of that news, he said. If my head it wasn't worth busting, it ain't worth patching. But she never paid no mind to that news. She washed his head off and dried it and put the bandage on and went out again, and Pat went and got into bed. Hand me my snuff. Then you get out of here and stay out too, he said. But before I could do that, Ma come back. She had a glass of hot toddy, and she went to the bed and stood there with it, and Pat turned his head and looked at it. What's that, he said. But Ma never answered, and then he sat up in bed and drawed a long, shuddering breath. He could hear it. And after a minute, he put his hand out for the toddy and sat there holding it, and drawing his breath, and then he took a sip of it. I got to, if him and all of them put together think they can keep me from working on my own strength like every other man, he better be a good man to try. He taking another sip of the toddy. Then he taking a long one. Arsonist, he said. Work unit, dog unit, and now arsonist. I got to, what are they? Let them be anything. I think if you try to rehearse the question first, it's not too good. Whether it seems suited to you or not, ask it. We'll take the gloves off. Yes, ma'am.
Would you discuss the religious symbolism in the sand here?
That was not accidental, but coincidental. The writer has a mass of lumber, just as the carpenter has from experience, observation. He is writing about people, and he reaches back into his experience, his observation, his memory to get what he thinks will be the most effective way to tell about the people he's talking about. And so I was not writing religious symbolism. I think I knew that because it made, I thought, my story better. Yes, the most important problem is the pressure to relinquish individuality and belong to something, to become a member of a mass. That's what the young writer has got to struggle against, because any art is composed, created in complete solitude. And the man or the woman has got to be primarily himself. He's got to believe in in men and women as individual men and women, not just as a mass of people. And so the greatest problem of the young writer is the time he lives in, the pressure to belong to something, be a member of a mass of something, and not himself. That's what it's like.
Well,
yes, ma'am.
Can you work at all?
Yes, a great deal. It's difficult for anyone to say because I think a writer is influenced by everything he ever reads from the telephone directory up and down. And when I was young, I read voraciously with no judgment, no discretion, no taste. I read everything and anything. And I'm quite sure it has all influenced me, but the writer, I think, is probably too busy to say, now let's see, I'll write a little George today. he's influenced by it, but he doesn't know how much, because he's too busy. That's part of the lumber in his storehouse that the carpenter uses when he's building his house of tips. Yes,
sir. Mr. Faulkner, every once in a while an author reports that what he intended as a short story got out of hand and turned into a novel. Have you ever had this experience? And if so, what novels were the result of it?
The Sound and the Fury began as a short story, I think. My own rating is the poet, next is the short story writer. Third is the novelist. The poet can say it in 14 lines or maybe four. The short story writer has got to have 1,000 or 2,000 words to say. The novelist has got to have up to 100,000. And I think that what any writer would want to be as a poet, I think to myself it would say a poet. But I couldn't be a poet and had sense enough to stop trying and to use a method which I couldn't. And so any story starts out as, well, a good poet could put it in a poem. A good short story writer could put it in a short story. You know, it takes him 1,000 words to say what he wants to say. The Sound of Fury, yes, began as a short story. I thought that could be done in 10 pages. Couldn't, it's not finished yet.
Yes,
it could be done. The reason it's not done in America is I gave a young woman who wants to be an actress and she has had bad luck. She's ambitious, she worked hard, but she hasn't been successful. I gave her the right to it. And since she has no reputation, no name, nobody will put up the money it costs to put on a play in this country. And I won't take it away from her. That's why it's been knocking about Europe for about 5 or 6 years. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Faulkner, I've noticed in a lot of your books you use double words, words that are usually used singly and are joined together. What effect are you trying to create with that? And why is in some novels you use them in the beginning of the book and then in the middle of the end you don't use them anymore?
That, I think, goes back to the constant fear that probably every writer has. He knows he's mortal. He has only a limited number of years in which to work. He has found the world so amazing and so marvelous and so moving that I mean by the world I mean man, the human race, the human problem, that he is trying to get it all said before he dies. That he is in a sense trying to put the whole history of the human heart on the head of a pin. And he is using any method that will do it, he thinks, the most effective, most moving way. And sometimes making one word out of two seems to me the best, and then again, it don't seem the right way to do it. It's that drive to get it all said while you can still have time to say it. I think that's the reason for the the experimenting with the style of method, that was the reason for joy. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned that the sound in the story period was still not finished. I was wondering, do you feel that there's any definite advantage in having the story more or less overlapping with others and keeping all the feeling of continuity and unfinishedness?
Well, it's not finished in the sense that